Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, here on Premier Christian Radio this Saturday evening and broadcasting all over the world via our podcast and indeed our YouTube channel as well. And got a really interesting, important discussion on critical race theory for you today. If you don't know what that is, you will hopefully by the end of the show with the help of my guests Russell Berry and Neil Shenvey. So we'll be hearing their debate on it very shortly. Lots of response to recent editions of the show, and I'll try to squeeze some of it in towards the end of this week's edition of the program. John Steingard and Amy Orr Ewing's fantastic conversation on suffering from a couple of weeks ago, and last week's big Trump debate that came courtesy of John Brown University between Eric Metaxas and David French. But just a reminder, if you want to keep up with Unbelievable, get our weekly newsletter, you can check out the links at the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And we've also recently launched that new website with special resources and a newsletter there for US listeners specifically at unbelievable.show. Our new Pathios blog is also available too if you want to keep up to date with some of the stuff we're posting there. Most recently, a blog on Russell Brand's prayers aren't far from Jesus, which has been written by our own Ruth Jackson, the newest team member here on Unbelievable. And I'm going to be sitting down to chat with Ruth about what she's up to, what she'll be bringing to the show in the future towards the end of today's program. So listen out for our get together towards the end of today's show as well. Now, something big to tell you about. I really want you to put this in your diary and turn up if you possibly can. Absolutely free live stream event that we're putting on our Facebook page and our YouTube channel this coming week. Wednesday, the 21st of October, we're going to be hosting Alistair McGrath, the famed Oxford theologian and former scientist, and he's got a great new book out called Through a Glass Darkly. It's his memoir, his journeys through science, faith and doubt. So I thought we'd have Alistair on the programme for a live stream edition of the show where you can ask questions on our Facebook page. You just need to be at the Unbelievable Facebook page on Wednesday, the 21st of October, this coming Wednesday, from 8 p.m. UK. That's 3 p.m. Eastern time, okay? So if you're able to come along then, you will be part of our Alistair McGrath live stream event. Hoping to also get that up on our YouTube channel as well. And don't worry, if you do miss it, we'll be making sure to bring it to you on a future edition of Unbelievable. Right now, time to get into this week's edition of the show.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Today on the show, we're discussing critical race theory and asking, is it compatible with Christianity? We're returning to the issue of race and culture as we debate CRT, as it's called for short. We'll find out what it is and why many Christians are split over it. And in a nutshell, but this is definitely going to be what we're going to be debating during the course of this show. You could say that critical race theory is the view that racism is at the center of the power dynamics of oppressed and oppressor, which lie behind the disadvantages and inequalities that exist in our world between people. Well, that's one definition anyway. We'll see what Neil and Razul, my guests on the show today, have to say and how they define it. Neil Shenvey is a homeschooling theoretical chemist and Christian apologist. And in recent years, he's become well known for his work critiquing critical theory. And he believes that the worldview of CRT is at odds with the Christian gospel and is worried by the embrace of its teachings by many evangelical leaders. Rasul Berry is teaching pastor at the Bridge Church in Brooklyn. And in a recent article titled Critical Grace Theory, he argues that CRT can actually be a helpful tool for understanding power dynamics in our world and working towards the peace and justice embodied in the gospel. So welcome, Neil and Rasul. Great to have you with me on the show today. Neil, I'll start with you because I know that you've followed Unbelievable for a while, and you'll be aware of some of the discussions we've had over the summer with various guests around Black Lives Matter and those sorts of issues. But tell us about how you particularly came into, you know, this being your specialism, if you like, in the last few years. What particularly got you engaged with critical race theory and critical theory in general?
Yeah, it was unexpected. So I was involved in apologetics for a long time, and I was very apolitical. I wanted to show non-Christians and my atheist colleagues as a scientist that Christianity was true, the gospel was true, that Jesus was who he claimed to be. And I kind of avoided cultural apologetics, as it's called. But then a few years ago, I began noticing both people that I knew personally and Christian leaders beginning to drift theologically, and I couldn't figure out why. It often began with an interest in social justice, but then they began espousing beliefs that were harder and harder to reconcile with orthodoxy, and some even became atheists. And I couldn't figure out why until I met my friend and collaborator, Dr. Pat Sawyer, who has a PhD in education and cultural studies, teaches at UNCG, and he wrote a dissertation that invoked critical theory. And he's really an expert in this area. And when I heard what he was doing, I said, this sounds very familiar. And so we got connected and I began to read voraciously and began to understand what was happening both in our culture and even in the evangelical church. And I think in the last, say, 6 months, we've really seen that cultural shift accelerate as more and more of mainstream culture and more of evangelical churches embrace these ideas.
Great to meet you on the show. And it's been really interesting reading and hearing some of your stuff over the last year or two. Also new to the show, Rasul Berry joins us, pastor of the Bridge Church in Brooklyn. Do you want to just describe what your church is like in Brooklyn, Rasul?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been there for 5 years. We're a six-year-old church plant in the heart of downtown Brooklyn. Our average age is 27-year-old, black and brown, millennial Gen Z is who we attract. People, we wanted to make a church for people who had kind of gotten tired of church and reimagining how to do that in a way that was still solid theologically, but culturally relevant and really speaking to the needs of where people are today. So that's kind of where we are as a church at the Bridge.
What's it been like pastoring a church through this last crazy 6 months, both the double whammy of obviously coronavirus, which has affected all churches, but also, of course, you know, all of the issues around the George Floyd protests and all of the tensions that has brought to the surface across the culture?
It's been unlike anything I've ever experienced before. I mean, obviously living in New York City, we were hit really hard. You know, outside of Wuhan, like the hardest hit in the very beginning, and even it surpassed that. And so very early on in March and, you know, April, we had to, you know, shut down and just, you know, I have parishioners who have family members. One parishioner lost 6 family members in the span of a month. Several others had their mothers on their deathbeds, and one died, but, you know, miraculously, you know, was resuscitated. So it's been, it was pretty intense all going up to, you know, May. And then, of course, the other pandemic of racial violence hit with, you know, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and then George Floyd. And it was kind of a twin, you know, just storm of difficulty to have to walk people through and pastor people through, especially people who, you know, were directly affected and very much afraid to go out jogging like Ahmaud Arbery, or what would happen if, you know, they went out into the street. And so we had to very much be very thoughtful in our preaching and in our ministering to know how to respond to these things that were very much at the forefront of what a lot of our parishioners were experiencing.
I'd love to chat with you more about that, but perhaps, you know, that'll come out in the course of the conversation today, some of the practical elements of how this is all obviously impacting people. This is a really interesting topic though, for me, because I've seen this phrase crop up so much in my social media, in articles, and I'm not even quite sure I still quite understand, because it's a very, I think, it covers a lot of ground, this phrase, critical race theory, doesn't it? But if it's possible, and this is always a difficult question, if it's possible in a nutshell, let's maybe start with you, Neil, how would you define this idea of critical race theory?
I would define it according to several core central tenets. So I'm going to take these from Yasso's paper, Whose Culture as Capital, which is cited over 6,000 times, which is a huge number of citations. And it provides, she lists five tenets of critical race theory in education. I'll summarize them, but I can give you the direct quotes, but I can kind of take my word for it that I'm not twisting it. So the central tenets of critical race theory, according to Yasso, are: first, racism is permanent, pervasive, and normal. Racial oppression has not disappeared, it has just evolved. Two, racism, sexism, classism, heterosexism, etc., are all inextricably linked forms of oppression that must be fought simultaneously. Third, claims of objectivity, neutrality, universality, meritocracy, and colorblindness, all in those scare quotes there, are mechanisms to disguise racism and oppression. They're excuses, they conceal actual racism. And then finally, the experiential knowledge or lived experience of people of color is critical to understanding racism. And one of the ways that racism operates is by suppressing what's called the epistemologies of people of color, how they know the truth. And we need to recover that by listening to their narratives, their stories that counter the typical colorblind narratives you'll hear from mainstream culture. So in a nutshell, that's what, I could quote Harper, Patton, and Wooden, Kumasi, Crenshaw, Delgado, and Stefan Schick, Gottesman, and pretty much all the scholars I've read outline critical race theory in roughly the same way.
I won't get you to go into detail on the wider field of critical theory, because we could do a whole other podcast on that, I'm sure. But that's a helpful kind of guide to some of the key points as you see them, Neil. Would you add anything to that, Neil, to Razul, or would you want to give your own definition of how you understand critical race theory?
I want to note first that it's interesting that Neil started with a discipline of education, which was not the original field from which this theory emerged, which was from the law, legal studies. And I think that alone kind of reflects and reveals the kind of amorphous way that this thing has kind of evolved over time and been picked up in, you know, interdisciplinary, across the academy, and can in some ways be hard to pin down. There were some things that were shared in that definition that I go, I think that's intrinsic. There were other things that I go, that I don't necessarily, you know, have seen that as definitely, something that would be considered universal. One definition I found helpful on Purdue University's site was critical race theory, or CRT, is a theoretical and interpretive mode that examines the appearance of race and racism across dominant cultural modes of expression. In adopting this approach, CRT scholars attempt to understand how victims of systemic racism are affected by cultural perceptions of race and how they are able to represent themselves to counter prejudice. I think that's obviously it's more narrow in its scope than the far-reaching implications that Neil defined. And I think that's actually kind of instructive to this conversation, is that, you know, you can probably find a few different definitions that wouldn't align up to each other.
And it's probably fair to say sometimes, Neil, that people try to push too much onto critical race theory potentially, because it can become a bit of a buzzword to mean just generally political correctness or something like that, can't it?
Right. Yeah. And that's why I try to go to the literature and not, you know, and say, well, this is what I find across, again, I could name, and it's a huge paper I just cited, 6,000 citations. These are extremely, you know, central core tenets that are espoused by everyone. Now, Rasul, I'd ask, you know, the definition you gave, it sounded kind of nebulous. It's like this is movement, it's a mode of expression. But the question I would ask is, if you define it that broadly, well, why wouldn't someone like Thomas Sowell, who's a well-known Black conservative, would he be doing critical race theory under your definition?
No. I think that, not based on that definition, I would say no.
So why exactly?
Well, explicitly, from what I understand, Thomas Sowell really hinges and focuses a lot on what would be considered the declining significance of race in general as an overall concept, or the overuse of it from a liberal kind of political philosophy approach to as a means of understanding disparities in our world and in our culture. Whereas critical race theory, I mean, one of the primary tenets actually is that race has explanatory power of interpreting and understanding the significance of those same disparities. So I think the very nature of it as a methodology or a theory is something that would not fit with what Sowell is trying to do.
I mean, that's right. And you mentioned that Sowell thinks it's declining in importance, but as I pointed out, one of the tenets that I've found everywhere is that it's permanent, pervasive, and normal, not aberrant. Again, I can quote like Delgado's and Stefanczyk critical race theory introduction and Crenshaw's CRT. My point is just that I think if you define it too nebulously, then it's hard to pin down what. So for example, I've seen people say, well, in some sense, Martin Luther King was a critical race theorist, even though he came, you know, 10 or 20 years before the very first critical race theorist. But if you define it that broadly, then I guess, sure, it can be compatible with Christianity. But I really want to pin down what, again, scholars, when they get specific about what it is, what are their beliefs? Those beliefs are what are incompatible, not just some vague, you know, method or some movement. Movements can mean a lot of things. Yeah.
What might be helpful in a sense is to move fairly quickly onto what your problems are then. Sure. And that might reveal kind of the differences that you and Rasul take when it comes to the way you understand critical race theory. I mean, just firstly, before we get to that, Rasul, I'd be interested to hear from you how you think this way of looking at racism, understanding that has informed the protests and the conversations that have been going on in the last, you know, 4 or 5 months.
Yeah. And that question actually leads to kind of my primary concern or critique of the whole conversation as a whole. So I, just a little bit of background. I'm from, born and raised in inner city Philadelphia, went to University of Pennsylvania, majored in Africana studies and sociology. And so I was all up in the social sciences as a discipline, as a perspective, became a Christian as a freshman, was very much formed by evangelicalism as I was developing in my own faith. And but throughout that process, both from an academic training standpoint, even though that was my degree, like this never was a thing that came up I'd never heard about it. Like, in fact, I didn't start hearing about it like a lot of Black Christians until as we were talking about issues of injustice, people were putting that label upon me. So I started to look at like, well, what are they talking about? I don't even understand what you're accusing me of. And then I go back and I go, okay. So there's a few problems with that. The first is that really the big question is the fact that many people, and I would say, you know, from what I've read from Neil, have an uncritical race theory. What I mean by that is they have no theory on race. Like, they just assume that it's a category that's just as neutral as gender or class. Whereas if you learn and go back to the history of race, going back to the 15th century, the Native American Christian author Mark Charles has done a lot of reading on the doctrine of discovery and how essentially the idea of race was codified through a series of papal bulls that were used to justify how it could be that Europeans could take over and discover, using scare quotes, lands that were already inhabited. And the essential explanation was that because they weren't human. It was a theory of humanity that said, okay, these people are not as fully human beings. The image of God is not as fully revealed in who they are than it is in who we are as Europeans. And so as a result of that, we get to conquest, rape, pillage, confiscate lands for the sake of the gospel, for the sake of Christ. That was part of so it was theology. It was a anthropology, a way of looking at people. And all of those things become codified in law, both in Europe and in the United States. So whether it's the Declaration of Independence, where you see we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, and then you go a few lines later and it says, you know, it complains that King George doesn't allow them to take over the merciless Indian savages, or if it's the Constitution, which calls, you know, slaves, enslaved people, black people, three-fifths of a person. This was a system, a way of looking at humanity that is now being trying to be critiqued. And that's part of the thing that I don't see. And so when you talk about what's happening on the streets, one of the things that Bryan Stevenson talks about, the author of Just Mercy, which just came out as a movie, is that while the North may have won the tactical war, that the South won the narrative war, that there was a war about the nature of who are human beings and who gets to participate in our society fully. And so that's where you get Jim Crow segregation. That's where you get all the things that happened in the 100 years that followed the end of the Civil War from 1865 to 1965. You have this, you know, attempt to maintain a racial caste system that was in place, because the very nature and notion of race was very much the foundation upon which these unjust systems emerge. And so I feel like if you don't have that understood, if that's not a full theory that you can actually understand and break down, then critical race theory begins to be even more confusing, because now you don't have a holistic way of actually seeing what it is, the fact of what they're trying to critique in the first place. So lastly, when I look at these movements of protest, very much they're related to the same struggle, because these in the same way that Bryan Stevenson talked about, once the Civil War ended, there was still 100 years of racial disparities that was codified de facto into law. Well, now we have de jure, where it's not necessarily legally explicit, but the vestiges of those systems still remain, and the ideas and the narratives of those systems still remain.
So if, Neil, CRT, critical race theory, is essentially unpacking and understanding that those disparities that have emerged through centuries of the way that race has been thought of and categorized and put into law and so on. In that sense, Rasool says it's potentially a helpful way of understanding, and it doesn't replace our Christian understanding necessarily, but it can inform it. It can help us to, you know, do justice and love mercy and treat each other all as made in the image of God and so on. So what are your key criticisms of this theory? And I'm sure then we'll have to go to a quick break and we'll hear Russell's responses.
Well, maybe I'll go a little bit, do that after the break, but I want to just say that actually one of the things I appreciated about Pastor Rasool's essay was that he says, as a result of common grace, we can learn from philosophers, scholars, and activists, regardless of their personal beliefs, and that we don't have to wholeheartedly embrace CRT or reject all it has to say about race and justice. He said that, and I actually agree. And one of the things I think that CRT gets right is how a concept of race and white and black races actually was a social construct that did create an effective racial casteism. I'm going to read, Rasool, I know that I write a lot, but you said I didn't really have a theory of race. Well, actually, I'm going to read from a quote from an essay that Pat and I wrote on Akemene Yuan's Sparrow Talk a year ago, but we wrote, the idea and concept of race is a modern development that came to prominence in the 17th century. We said it was a purposeful attempt to justify slavery and to concentrate power within the hands of people of European origin. The U.S. did indeed develop a kind of racial caste system which placed whites at the top and blacks at the bottom. So I understand that. I think this is one of the areas that critical race theory does get right, and we can say, look at history and say, yeah, actually, they're right. When I read quite a bit of critical race theory, when I read their views on the construction of race in the U.S., I generally think they get it right. So my concerns are not the things they get right. My concerns are, number one, the things they get wrong, and more than that, the fact that their foundations, their core tenets on which they build these theories, are deeply wrong and poisonous. And I guess we'll do that after the break, Justin.
Well, look, we've got a couple of minutes. We've got a few minutes. Right. So why don't you give us maybe one, two, maybe three, if we can squeeze them in, and then we'll go to Rasool
Let me just give you one. So critical race theory, like I said, I can quote many critical race theorists saying this is a core tenet of the theory. but they connect racism, sexism, classism, and heterosexism as all linked forms of oppression. The term they use is interlocking systems of oppression. That's an extremely central idea. And actually, you can see in Pastor Rasool's essay, he picks up on that. He says, you know, why is it so hard for some Christians to see the value of CRT's critique of racism? Because they're mapping out race. And he says, when people map out by power, by pointing out racial or gender privilege, it can cause our defenses to go up. So I'm quoting him again. He says, I know that defensive reflex firsthand because when my male privilege needed to be called out, you know, he gets defensive. So in other words, Pastor Rasool sees that, yeah, there's white privilege and there's male privilege, but critical race theorists would say yes, and there's class privilege and heterosexual privilege. They're all interlocking. So for example, in his essay, Critical Race Theory, Archie Chapman, Fire Music, John Calmore writes, adherents of critical race theory see an interlocking set of oppressions that extend beyond the singular base of race and include the bases of gender, economic class, and sexual orientation. Ibram Kendi, the author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, says, to be an anti-racist is to be a feminist. To be truly a feminist is to be anti-racist. We cannot be anti-racist if we are homophobic or transphobic. Wildman and Davis write, white privilege derives from a system of white supremacy, male privilege, and heterosexual privilege result from the gender hierarchy. So again, these are critical race theorists who are saying it's all connected. You can't just pick apart race. You have to see race, class, gender, sexuality, physical ability, age, immigration status as interlocking forms of oppression. And right off the bat, Christians are going to say, wait a minute, I don't believe that the gender binary is oppressive. I don't believe that gender roles are oppressive. But critical race theory is built on, especially since intersectionality in 1989-91 with Kimberly Crenshaw, it's built on the recognition that these things are indeed related forms of oppression. So that there's one huge area where we have to say that fundamental idea that's, again, in the core tenets of critical race theory must be rejected by Christians.
We'll come back to you for a response on that in just a moment, Rasool. Thank you very much. And I'm sure there'll be other issues to discuss in the ways that Neil, the issues Neil has with aspects of CRT. But we're doing an in-depth dive on this subject today on Unbelievable. Is critical race theory compatible with Christianity? We're asking. My guests are Neil Shenvey and Rasool Berry. We'll be back after a short break.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the second part of today's show. We're asking, is critical race theory compatible with Christianity? Neil Shenvey and Rasool Berry are my guests, and I'll make sure there are links from today's show to them if you want to find out more about their work and their ministries. So in that last section, Neil was saying the problem with embracing critical race theory, Rasool, is that you then have to embrace everything else about critical theory and all these various different categories of power and oppression and so on. And that might lead to Christians being uncomfortable potentially with saying we need to deconstruct gender categories and sexuality categories and other things. So how much do you agree with that you have to kind of take it as a whole in that way?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a good question, a good point that Neil brought up. And it actually kind of, I'm going to go a little bit outside of my field of, into his world of chemistry for a second. So I'm going to get myself in a lot of trouble. But the word chemistry comes from alchemy, which referred to the earlier set of practices that encompass elements of chemistry, metallurgy, philosophy, astronomy, astrology, mysticism, and medicine. And of course, when we think about alchemy, the biggest thing, right, of the idea of turning other materials into gold. And yet over time, that word got to a place and changed in its significance and all of its clarity to bringing it to a point now where it involves theories and discoveries that function within kind of the realm of established science. Now, I kind of feel like sometimes I might use the word chemist and someone is investing into me all of the alchemy history and all of the converse, you know, problematic astronomy and mysticism philosophies, that I'm like, well, that's not what I mean by when I say a chemist. And so in the same way, there is, I think, one, a problem with what I'm addressing. If this was merely in the realm of the academy and theorists, we wouldn't really be having this conversation. But what's happened is, and again, how I had discovered the term is and how many of my other brothers and sisters in the faith and of color have experienced this, is we're talking about George Floyd's being killed after his being knelt on for 8 minutes and 46 seconds and saying, this is unjust. Something should be changed. The law, you know, that we live in a racist society. And then we are told, oh, you have just been held captive to this ideology called critical race theory. And so now it's like, well, what are you talking about? I'm just trying to respond to the very injustices that I'm seeing all around me. And so I think that one of the differences that exists is that there are people who have theories about race. Like I said, they're uncritical race theories. And by the way, Neil, what I meant by that wasn't that, you know, you didn't have any kind of a concept of race as a social construct, but what I have found, and again, I haven't read, you write a lot, bro. So I haven't read it all, but in the aspects that I saw, there wasn't a full robust analysis of what is happening today and how that is influenced by this concept of race, both not just talking about slavery, not just talking about 50 years ago, but the very concept of race and how it used now and how it's intrinsically been tainted by these unbiblical, sinful patterns of thinking about humans and organizing humans. And so in terms of So I just wanted to say, I'm only in this conversation because I'm being given a label that I really don't care that much about. And I really want the church to be talking about the death that is in the street, the disparities. COVID right now has a disproportionate impact on people of color, you know, in some places twice as likely to die as white people. We're seeing this across education, across, you know, healthcare, across, you know, just economics, every field. And it's like, that needs to be talked about. I would much rather have a conversation about that than I would about a theory that is amorphous and whatnot. But anytime you talk about that in many Christian circles, you are giving this title. So that's the dilemma of saying, okay, there are elements of this that resonate with me. But the last thing I'll say to that is that it resonates because the Black church was already talking about this over 150 years ago. I have a whole tradition that I am tapping into, from Frederick Douglass to Sojourner Truth to Harriet Tubman to Richard Allen, that we're always talking about this. Sure. But yet when I talk about it, I'm being labeled as being influenced by social science.
As you say in your article, you know, you're tapping into this ain't, you know, this long running tradition,
right?
And obviously leaders of the civil rights movement like Martin Luther King and so on, and they wouldn't necessarily have known what you meant by critical race theory, but it's just that there is obviously overlap between sort of with what critical race theory says and the impetus for justice at a more simple level. But so what's the problem there then, Neil? Because many people would say, you know, it's not as though the Bible doesn't talk about categories of oppressed and oppressor. It's not as though the Bible doesn't talk about us having to see things in a fresh way. You know, when I think of Paul's words about don't be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. There's something about almost, you know, being awakened, the wokeness, if you like, of Christianity is to not get trapped into patterns. And at its best, as I understand critical race theory and how Rasul sees it, it's about seeing beyond sometimes the ways in which culture shapes us, to see other people's points of view and how they experience life in that way. So if that's the kind of the positive way in which we could categorize CRT, what's your problem with that kind of way of looking at it?
Okay, so it happens a lot of times that, you know, critical race theory and critical theory more broadly has taken terms that are familiar words like oppression, and it's actually explicitly redefined them. So for example, as Pastor Rasul says in his essay, that a critical theorist, you know, broadly are attuned to the abuse of power, which can be the result of, he says, quote, wealth, ideological dominance, this hegemony, he says, or the power to shape language and or physical domination via state-sanctioned violence, to name a few. And that's exactly right. So critical theory, critical race theory, does view oppression not just as coercion and tyranny, but as the power to shape ideology, right? That's oppression. And that's how they understand it. And that's why they would say we live in, say, as Pastor Russell said, a racist society. Why? Because we have this, the ruling class, whites, has imposed their system, their ideology onto culture. They've classified whites and blacks, and they've classified themselves as normal and valuable, and they've classified people of color as abnormal, lesser, and other. And that means there's an oppressor group, whites, and oppressed groups, people of color. That's how you get these categories. They would see that's how the theory works. But if that's your definition of oppression, that oppression occurs not just through violence and tyranny, but through ideological power, hegemony, well, then I accept that with respect to race, but if that's your definition of oppression, then you also have to believe that women and LGBTQ people are oppressed because the ruling class, men and heterosexuals, have imposed their norms and values on culture in the same way. That's what I'm getting at here, Justin, is that it's not that CRT's views just come out of nowhere. They come out of, again, a sort of a worldview, an ideology, and everything fits together. It's coherent. So we hear a word like oppression, we're like, well, the Bible talks about oppression as a bad thing, but we have to understand that the way they're using that word, or words like racism and white supremacy, are in unusual ways that are informed by their, it's called a worldview, call it their larger ideology, and that's the problem. Set aside the issue of gender and sexuality, but Muslim Christians say, well, okay, I see that that's a problem. A lot of critical race theorists say that that's central to their discipline, that seeing sex, gender, race, class as all intertwined, that's important to them, but I have to reject that as a Christian. I'll just use it to view race, okay? Well, here's the problem there. They even get race really wrong. Another big, huge conflict is in their view of epistemology, how you know the truth. So again, one of their core tenets is that racism hides behind claims of objectivity and colorblindness. And to really understand racism, we have to listen to the lived experience of people of color, right? Well, what does that do? If you really believe that, what do you do when someone says to you that your gospel is not the real gospel, that what you believe is this truncated, individualistic, white evangelical gospel? For example, in his book, Reconstructing the Gospel, Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove writes, the gospel of white evangelicals hasn't interrupted our racial habits, it's reinforced them. In America, racial politics has always been Christian. Co-opting the poor refugee Christ to defend white supremacy, we miss the basic message of the gospel. It goes on and on about how we all have embraced slaveholder religion. Now, if you're a white person, now he's white, interestingly, but if you're a white person, how do you respond to that claim that you don't know the gospel? Well, if you say, well, but the Bible says this, they'll say that's your white European Western interpretation of the Bible. You're blinded by your white privilege. And so, but no, my interpretation is objectively true. Well, that's objectivity is a cloak for racism and white supremacy. What if you're a person of color? Like I'm half Indian. What if I say, wait a minute, that's not true. The gospel I believe really is the gospel the Bible teaches. Well, in that case, critical race theorists will say that I have internalized oppression. You know, I've imbibed white evangelicalism. And so I'm just parroting back their talking points. There's no way to answer them. This epistemology says.
And why, you know, people land hard sometimes on people like when Beth Moore, for instance, well-known Bible teacher on Twitter says, I need to decolonize my theology bookshelf or whatever.
Yeah.
You have a problem with that because you think that suggests there are many ways of interpreting scripture. There are many ways of that there isn't one objective truth, if you like, in the gospel. Well, that's the claim that's coming out from that.
So not exactly. So critical theorists are actually not postmodernists in a radical sense. They believe truth is out there, but they believe that oppressed people have special access to that truth. So when she says, I want to decolonize my bookshelf, think how weird it would sound to say, I need to decolonize my math book or my science textbooks. I need to decolonize those. No, you don't. Why? Well, because those are objectively true. Well, wait. Are your Bible commentaries not? That's the question. So, what does she mean exactly? So Well, I'm not saying clearly we can get a lot.
I'd love to hear Rasul's response to this, because this I think is key, Rasul. Is the Bible commentary written by a white Anglo-Saxon Eurocentric person inevitably colored by that person's experience, and that you don't get the full truth from that unless you also are putting it next to people's other experiences and the way they interpret the gospel?
Man, there's so much. I'm just going to try my best. There was so much there to respond to. It reminds me, I'm at Reformed Theological Seminary right now, and shout out to Jay Harvey, the executive director. He gave me this as a food for thought on this. The church is being brought ethical concerns and is responding with epistemological critique. That's like a man telling you he's bleeding and you ask him, how did you come to that conclusion? That's part of what's happening here. That's hard to wrap your head around. It's similar to, I feel like, Job's friends, of just kind of pummeling someone with a bunch of, you know, rejoinders when you're like, yo, I'm suffering. But to answer that epistemological thing, because I did see, Neil, you wrote that to critical theorists, these totalitizing, comprehensive, exclusive claims are utterly unacceptable from the perspective of contemporary critical theory. God is the ultimate oppressor. And you refer to lived experience as a problem with that, and I think that from an apologist standpoint, we know that there are different forms of knowledge. There's propositional knowledge, this, if this, then that. There's procedural knowledge, such as learning how to ride a bike. There's direct awareness, knowledge by acquaintance. I know how it feels to stub my toe. So when you say, yo, I stubbed my toe and it hurt, I can be like, yeah, I understand that. However, if someone were to say, wow, I just had twins and it hurt, I'd have to be like, I don't know what that's like. I have no frame of reference for understanding what it's like to give birth to twins. Some of this is just basic epistemology, and it's stuff that even in our own tradition, even in the Reformed tradition, you see people like Herman Bavinck, who talk about the various ways in which knowledge, come to us, and how important it is for us to be aware of it. I think that there's an extreme that happens in either side of this, where on the one end you have epistemological hubris that says, of course I can know and explain and understand everything that you are going through and see, and I have no blinders. And then you have an extreme epistemological suspicion and skepticism of all truth. And I'm not arguing for either of those. I'm saying that what we can say, and the Bible doesn't argue for either of those, but what it does say is that there are certain things that people who are marginalized and oppressed are going to catch and experience by way of their lived experiences. That's not to say, and ironically, even the very people he's quoting, some of the greatest influencers in my own thinking on race have been white people. So it's not that that critical theorists like Jean Stefanchik, who is white herself, who's writing this, they're not saying that it's impossible for someone to understand something and move in that other direction, and you have to just be an oppressor and that's your own state. But it is saying that there needs to be room made for a value of an epistemology that says that we need to listen. So we need to listen to people whose perspective, from being marginalized and oppressed by this racist system that has existed since for the last several centuries, what they talk about. So when someone talks about decolonizing theology, I'm so glad you brought that up, Neil, because you asked, like in one of your essays, what does that exactly mean? Does that mean we have to jettison documents like the Westminster Confession? No, absolutely not. That's not what it means. But what it does mean when we talk about decolonizing theology, we also have to look at the fact that if I read Jonathan Edwards and see that he was one of the most influential evangelical thinkers of the time, and he justified chattel slavery. If I read George Whitefield and I see that he also justified chattel slavery, changed his position when it became financially convenient. When I see anti-Semitism in certain writings of various people, that I have to recognize and acknowledge that came, that in addition to the lofty, beautiful truths that I hold to, and I can say, yes, this is God revealed revealed, inspired revelation, I also have to look at the things that said either your complicity in a system and a behavior in a system that was racist, or your silence in a system. When we look at just over the last 100 years, I mean, Bob Jones University, which Bob Jones was a well-known evangelist in his time, one of the most famous, started a university in South Carolina that barred interracial marriage until the year 2000 on their campus, 20 years ago. So this isn't, you know, you're talking this millennial that I have to look at that. I hope that a black person was at Bob Jones University and was decolonizing their theology when they were told that they were less than a person. Absolutely, we have to do that.
Neil.
Yeah. I would just say, you know, Russell, you said, do we have to get rid of, you know, the creeds of the Reformation? Absolutely not. Well, that's why I said, well, what do you mean by that? You would not mean get rid of the Reformation, get rid of the all-male books of the Bible and find some female authors who, you know, write inspired literature. You're not saying that. But here's the thing. Some people are. So at the conference, Liberating Evangelicalism, which was sponsored by InterVarsity Press, Erdmann's, North Park Seminary, Fuller Seminary, and Evangelicals for Justice, Professor Angela Parker tweeted this out. She said, inerrancy and infallibility are orthodoxies of white supremacist thought. Lisa Sharon Harper said, the doctrines of inerrancy shut down our ability to look at the Bible in all its complexity and is a doctrine of whiteness. So some people really are, some evangelicals really are saying things like, decolonize your theology by getting rid of all these musty old doctrines like inerrancy.
But some chemists believe in evolution. And some, I mean, like, what? Like, I don't understand why we can eat the meat and spit out the bones in every other discipline. But then when it comes to something about critiquing race, it's like, oh my gosh, somebody says something like that. So that means I have to wrestle with if everybody believes that.
Sure. So I totally agree. One of my pet, not pet peeves, but I definitely hear the concern that, hey, I talk about race and everyone calls me a critical race theorist. I talk about justice, they call me a cultural Marxist. I get that I'm not even remotely doing that. Okay. I see that concern. It's legitimate. The question today is, what about critical race theory itself? If you ask, if you actually ask the chemist, do you believe in like alchemy and the four humors? And they say, no way. What are you talking about? But if you ask a critical race theorist, what defines your discipline? They will tell you these things do. So I have no problem with saying, I want to use some of these ideas that are actually true. Ideas like race is a social construct. That's a true statement, right? I can, and if a critical race theorist says that, if a Muslim says that, I can affirm it because it's actually true. But the underlying tenets that are central to their discipline, I have to reject. And so, for example, lived experience, I completely agree that our lived experience has some value evidentially. I had Cheerios for breakfast, or I said I had a protein bar for breakfast. That's my lived experience. It's also true. You don't have to question me, but here's the thing. The ultimate authority is not our lived experience. It's scripture. And what's more, because of the perspicuity of scripture, all people from all social locations can interpret it well. Now, should we listen to other people? Absolutely. Should we go outside of our tradition and say, what are they saying about scripture? Is it true? Absolutely. We shouldn't just try to find commentators and theologies that are non-white. We should try to find doctrines and commentaries that are actually true because they comport with scripture. That's the difference.
I mean, you said, looked like you were agreeing with some of that, Rasul. And in that sense, you're quite clear in your essay, Critical Grace Theory, that you're not sort of saying, I'd agree with everything everyone in the critical, you know, all the key voices in critical race theory say. I mean, what obviously, a lot of people are very concerned, though, that by imbibing, by sort of speaking in the terms of critical race theory, that we're somehow then imbibing the worldview, larger worldview, as Neil puts it.
Yeah, when you talk about the concern, several years ago, John MacArthur wrote, the most dangerous heresy that he's ever faced is the growing Christian advocacy for social justice. Just this week, Owen Strachan, associate professor at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, called for church discipline, invoking Matthew 18 for anybody who he identified as a woke Christian or who was promoting wokeness. Excommunication. There are heresy hunters who are compiling lists of theologians and pastors like Dr. Eric Mason, who wrote the book Woke Church, got his doctorate at Dallas Theological Seminary, considers Dr. Tony Evans a mentor as someone who's now anathema, who is now bringing in heresy. Phil Vischer, who gave us VeggieTales, is now in this category of those who are postmodern Marxists. This is the conversation. This is why this is so important, because there are now people who are saying all of this is under the same umbrella and needs to summarily be rejected, and these people ought to be shunned. That's what we're dealing with. And so I think that, yeah, there are aspects of critical race theory, as I had to learn and study it, because it wasn't natural. It wasn't something that even with the Africana studies major at a major university that I had run across in a systemic way. And that's important because it didn't shape or frame my analysis of the world having a significant racist past and history and present. But what does occur is this aspect of worldview thinking and in the way that how that shapes and what we can take and imbibe and what is interwoven. And some of what makes this complex, Dr. Esau McCulley has said, is that there are complexities because there's such much of the same conversation that has already been happening within the Black church. But because oftentimes people, Christian theologians, don't take the Black Christian tradition seriously, they overlook and ignore that. There's a presumption of guilt upon anybody who brings up issues of injustice and race as just being all the way and part of this process. And it's a word that is not in season for what is happening right now. There's more attention, more energy, and more focus on the dangers of this, you know, this ideology are being tethered to what and then being projected onto what we're saying than it is on the actual problem of racism in our society. We are in the midst of the largest movement of social justice that we've seen in our country, and what Christians are doing now in mainstream are having an argument about epistemology versus ethics. And again, I'm not saying epistemology isn't important. It's very important. But what I am saying is that just because I resonate with various topics like intersectionality, and by the way, I don't have any problem with saying women experience oppression in our society. LGBT people experience being alienated and oppressed in our society. Like those are facts. Now, do I mean by that the same thing as, you know, what, you know, Crenshaw means by that, and or what Delgado means by that? Probably not. And I'm fine with that. That doesn't mean that I retreat from being able to acknowledge that there is brokenness and that there's pain and that there's abuse in our world. And I think we have to hold those things together. We absolutely, it's critical. And I need folks who are more fair-minded, like Neil, to push back on this tsunami that is coming. That they're, when people start talking about excommunicating folks, that means that they're looking for people to say, okay, you use the word race, you use the word injustice, so now you're going to have church discipline. That's what's happening now.
Yeah. And I get the sense there, just before we go to a break, Neil, that Razul does believe you can take the good and leave the parts that you don't necessarily agree with. You can, you know, eat the meat and spit out the bones, as it were. You obviously don't feel that you get to do that with CRT for some reason.
Well, here's the comparison I like to make. It's between CRT and queer theory. Now, do queer theorists say absolutely nothing but falsehoods all the time? No. You know, a queer theorist might say something like, you know, particular elements of what we call masculinity and femininity are actually social constructs. And that could be true. For example, dinosaurs and the color blue and fire engines are not inherently masculine, and unicorns and the color pink and rainbows aren't inherently feminine. So they'd be right there. But here's the problem. While that limited insight is true, the entire project of queer theory is predicated upon an absolutely deadly falsehood that all elements of gender are socially constructed, that gender itself is an oppressive social construct that needs to be dismantled. So we can't just say, well, I'll eat the meat and spit out the bones. And the analogy I use again is that the meat's poisoned, that the very project of queer theory is poisonous. So do they say some true things? Yes, but their fundamental project is dangerous. And I think we should view CRT in a similar way, because they're sort of kissing cousins in a sense. They're related in terms of how they view power and oppression. So that's why I say, You know, I've read literally thousands of pages of CRT at this point. I can guarantee you, I can confirm, it is not 100% garbage. It's not. Some of it's,
But you think that there is ultimately this agenda to kind of basically dismantle the hierarchies and so on. And as far as you're concerned, that means dismantling a lot of Christian orthodoxy at the same time.
Yeah, depending, again, when you, so for example, when Rasul says, you know, I also believe LGBTQ people are oppressed, but not the same way that they might. Well, that's, I hope that's true, because when they say that they're oppressed, they mean they want to dismantle the things that are oppressing them, which would be the gender binary. When they say they want to dismantle whiteness, they mean they want to dismantle things that we might say are actually, that's not whiteness, that's actually things like Christian doctrine. Actually, the Smithsonian had an infographic which listed Judeo-Christian morality as an element of whiteness. So, which is crazy, but it was there. The Smithsonian said that, you know, drawing on critical race theory. So we have to be very, not just even careful, I would say we should be, boy, oh boy, more than careful when we start adopting this language and these ideas, because they're dangerous.
Quick response, and we'll go to the break. Rasul, yeah.
I mean, it was more of a question. Like, I am making the case that white supremacy and racism is the greatest challenge. This is, it wasn't me that said this, Daniel Hill in his book, White Lies, to unity in the church than anything else right now. What do you see when you see this amalgamation of white nationalism, of, you know, just this intersection of, you know, beliefs with this Make America Great Again kind of motif of like, we have to, Jews will not replace us kind of ideology. Do you see that? Do you see any infiltration of nationalism and xenophobia or racism in the mainstream evangelical church at all? Do you see that?
I do see it. But here's the thing. One thing I would say is that critical race theory has redefined white supremacy to mean whiteness being the norm, where whiteness means like the culture and the values of the, you know, of white. It's complicated. They've redefined these terms. So you have to be, when you ask, well, is white supremacy in the traditional sense the biggest problem in the church today? Even there, I'd say I don't like to rank heresies. It's a problem, absolutely. But here's my concern. I don't know any pastors, even the most radically conservative fundamentalist pastors, who wouldn't get in the pulpit and say racism is a wicked sin, white supremacy is a wicked sin. I know people who are radically fundamentalist and conservative who would say that. Yet I see tons of people who would not be willing to do that about critical race theory, which I would say is equally poisonous. Let's do both. I am happy to denounce traditional racism, traditional white supremacy. But I want to also denounce these ideas because they are, and I can give you lots of examples, but they are entering the evangelical church and having a disastrous effect on our theology.
We're going to go to a quick break, and I'll come back to you, Rasul, because, I think this point about whether there's equally a sort of a way in which a kind of nationalistic kind of politicization that is entering the American politics. And I see this from over here in the UK as a Brit, and we look on with a certain amount of trepidation as to what's going to be happening, obviously, in a few weeks' time. Look, we'll go to a break and we'll come back to these issues. Critical race theory is under debate today. Fantastic conversation between Neil Shenvey and Rasul Berry here on the show. And we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Always lovely to hear from new listeners. Mark got in touch to say, great show. The IDW is dead. Long live the IBW, the intellectual bright web. The problem the IDW had was that a significant majority of their shows and podcasts were just giving guests a chance to have a platform to express their views unchallenged. The fact that Unbelievable actively encourages debates from two different camps is fantastic and a much better model for hopefully changing mindsets. I'm getting a lot of encouragement from recent shows and the back catalogue. Many thanks and God bless. Thank you, Mark, for getting in touch. We'll hear a few more of your messages and feedback to recent editions of the show towards the end of today's program. Also got that interview with Ruth Jackson, newest member of the Unbelievable team. So we'll hear about some of the plans that Ruth and I are cooking up together a little bit later on. Still to come tonight, you can hear The Profile. And today it's Jermaine, the former X Factor finalist, on his Christian faith and music career, sitting down with Sam Hales to talk about that at 8 p.m. And you can find that on its own Profile podcast. And next week on the show here on Unbelievable, it's the Ask Alistair McGrath Anything edition of the program. But you can be part of that live by joining us for the live stream on our Facebook page this Wednesday, the 21st of October at 8 p.m. That's in the UK. If you're in America or in the US, 3 p.m. Eastern time, if you want to be join that live. Alistair has recently published a memoir, Through a Glass Darkly, Journeys Through Science, Faith and Doubt. So we hope to make that live on our YouTube channel at the same time. So check that out this Wednesday, the 21st of October. Be there for the Ask Alistair McGrath Anything live stream, 8 p.m. UK, 3 p.m. Eastern time.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So in the final part of today's show, we're continuing this discussion on critical race theory. Is it compatible with Christianity? Is it an anathema to Christianity? That's what Neil Shenvey believes, one of my guests on today's show. I'll make sure there are links to Neil from today's program. Rasul Berry, the teaching pastor at the Bridge Church in Brooklyn, recently wrote an article called Critical Race Theory. Now, without endorsing every aspect of critical race theory, he said, however, it is very often a helpful tool to help us understand the power dynamics going on in culture and to help us respond as Christians as we seek to bring truth and light and peace and justice into them. So just before we get back into the conversation we were having, one phrase leapt out at me during that last part of the conversation, and it was cultural Marxism. Can you explain, maybe start with you, Rasul, what you think that means and why it's come into suddenly common parlance and particularly linked with this idea of critical race theory?
Yeah, as someone who's been accused of being a cultural Marxist on many occasions, I had to look it up to figure out what it was that people were accusing me of. It's essentially this idea that, it's evolved over time. When you first see it initially, I can't remember his last name.
Lind.
Thank you. Bill Land, in the 90s, is writing about it in response to what he's looking at as political correctness at the time. That was the big hot button issue, and using the right terms and saying that political correctness is an expression of Marxism in the terms of controlling what you can say or how you express yourself. It has now evolved over the last 20, 30 years to mean basically kind of be lumped into this idea of talking about oppression, since Marx and others like the Frankfurt School, who are very much Marxists and things, that there's this this vision of the world, this analysis that looks at a dialectic of oppressor and oppressed classes, that's essentially a Marxist concept, and that ultimately what cultural Marxists seek to do is essentially, as opposed to the old method, which was to do violent overthrow of the government, that a new school decided, oh, well, that didn't really work out too well, or let's try to persuade hearts and minds with the same ideology. And then that way, you know, we can kind of have this Trojan horse come into society and then take it over. Interestingly enough, there's it's the son of another idea called cultural Bolshevikism, which was coined in Germany in the 1930s, which had to do with anything that was associated with or thought to be Marxist, or at that point Bolshevik. And it included abstract art. It was a broad construct that was used to primarily paint as anti-Semitic Jewish people. So cultural Bolshevism in the 30s, which leads into the Third Reich, and then cultural Marxism is basically the same term, just updated. And it's a conspiracy theory, ultimately, that is so broad in its implication that anything can fit into it, and everything that sounds anything different than what people look at as the status quo. That's my perspective on cultural Marxism.
How helpful is this phrase in your view, Neil?
So I think it's unhelpful because if you Google the phrase cultural Marxism, like half the links say it's a conspiracy theory, it's anti-Semitic, it goes back to Bill Lind. So it's half the links. Now, unfortunately, that's just not true. There's a great article called Cultural Marxism, Imaginary Conspiracy or Revolutionary Reality, published by the Gospel Coalition's journal Themelios, written by Robert Smith. It's 10,000 words long. It's very long and detailed. But he points out that the phrase cultural Marxism has been around for decades and was used by scholars to describe the work of the Frankfurt School. So it's not a conspiracy theory. It really exists.
No. What I said is the term, the semantic range of the term has been stretched to include everything under the sun in the same way that cultural Bolshevism is. So even when the way Bill Land used it in the 90s is not the way it's being talked about now. It's different. So that stretching is the thing that I'm saying has become unhelpful and unuseful, because basically it's become anything that sounds different than what a certain political and social ideology has been.
Okay. So yeah, I agree it's unhelpful, but it's not, it does actually, it's a real academic term. It's been used for decades by people who promoted it. So it's not just a conspiracy theory.
But real quick, I just want to say, in the same way that you refer to those terms like intersectionality or oppression as terms that can have a whole lot invested in it, I'm saying that cultural Marxism is the same way.
It's obviously covers a wide range of bases these days, and people do tend to throw it around. I mean, the problem is, as I see it, you're both in that sense anti-racist, but even the term anti-racism has now come to become a loaded term. And when I first heard the word anti-racist, I thought, well, yeah, any sensible person, right-thinking person should be anti-racist. But now a lot of people seem to think it involves a certain way of seeing the world and this critical race theory approach to things and everything else. So it's very hard, isn't it? Because the terms change and different people have different, you know, views of what's involved in any particular thing. I did want to come back to you, Razul, with some more thoughts, because I get the sense that you haven't wanted to adopt this label for yourself, critical race theory. You're saying it doesn't explain everything about me, you know, and ultimately you're a Christian first and foremost before you are in any sense a critical race theorist. Mm-hmm. But that you simply believe there's been a bit of a knee-jerk sort of defensive reaction to the use of it in evangelical circles.
Yeah, and it's founded historically. I mean, every time there has been a there's a book Mark Knoll wrote, Civil War as a Theological Debate. And you look at the approach of in the 1850s and 60s of the two sides in Christianity, one were opposed to slavery, the other, you know, were supporting of it, that essentially the side that was opposed to it were labeled as heretical, as, oh, you're not really committed to the Bible like we are, because if you were, you'd see that there's no problem with slavery. And anytime, any attempt to broaden and say, wait a minute, there's some themes of liberation in the scripture that are clearly here, and clearly whipping and raping and kidnapping millions of people can't fit into a Christian ethos. Well, there was a whole war fought about it. And theologically, that's how you get the Baptist convention. That's how you get the Presbyterian PCA convention. Like, there are literally churches that split. Same thing in segregation. You have, if you just Google like segregation signs, Bible verses, you'll see people holding up signs that say integration is communism. Integration is, you know, segregation is biblical. And that's the theme. That's why a place like Bob Jones University would have a ban on interracial relationships until the year 2000. And it only changed then because of the pressure that got put on it when President George Bush visited the campus. And so when we see this new iteration, I'm not surprised that there is a consternation when we bring up issues of race and injustice, that there are people are pushing back on that, because that has been the pattern every time that this has come up in American history and really, you know, in world history. But I think that it's so and I think about critical race theory again. I only have these conversations in evangelical space. Like that's not a something I think about or I interact with on as a way of defining how I think about the world. Are there some things that I've learned that I've embodied that I feel like are valuable, such as intersectionality, that I think there's some helpful things there? Not everything. Yeah. White fragility. Does that explain some observable phenomena that I know to be true and that I've experienced? Yes. Now, do I agree with everything with Robin DiAngelo, I'm butchering her name, but you know, the author of the books has said no. And so, but again, I've had to do that when I open my theology books and I see people talking about the curse of Ham, and I see people talking about that that's a justification for slavery. Or if I read sermons or, you know, old treatises from people who were using the Bible to justify oppression, that I've had to also do the same thing. So it's not like I look at it as all truth is God's truth. And so anytime I come into something that a human has written, that I have to look at that upon with scrutiny, but also realize that there's some wisdom that can be gained from it.
Neil, we're going to start wrapping things up, but yeah, would you like to respond? And then we'll start to get some final thoughts from you both.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with Rasul that there are two dangers here. One is to label everybody who's, you know, everyone is a critical race theorist, everyone's a cultural Marxist, anyone who talks about justice is, you know, a communist. I agree that's a problem. I'm fully behind that. I really want to be precise, accurate, charitable. That's all fine. But I want him to also recognize there's another side of the problem. There's another huge problem within evangelicalism today. And I'm going to pull out some quotes and I want him and other people like him to speak out. If he says, eat the meat, spit out the bones, well, then identify the bones for us. Tell us exactly how dangerous this is. It's really dangerous. So there's a book published in 2019 called Can White People Be Saved? Published by InterVarsity Press with a number of Fuller Seminary professors writing there. It says explicitly they draw on cutting edge theory and racial studies and critical theorists who analyze race. Here are some quotes. Here's one from Andrea Smith's essay, Decolonizing Salvation. What we presume to be true of the Bible is primarily the result of the history of European interpretation as translated into European languages. We would have a completely different understanding of the Bible if we read it through indigenous languages. According to the European positivist grammar of truth, if proposition P is true, then not P must be false. Indigenous epistemologies, indigenous ways of knowing, are not beholden to such logic systems. Beliefs like Christianity and indigenous religions can coexist in indigenous culture. She's saying, I know that it sounds like Christianity and indigenous religions are contradictory, and they are, according to European logic. But if we get rid of that European logic, then they can coexist. Here's an essay called The End of Mission by Andrew Draper. Whiteness is best understood as a religious system of pagan idol worship. It's as idolatry, whiteness must be dealt with like any such cultic system. Its high places must be torn down and its altars laid low. Christian discipleship that entails a deconversion from whiteness is necessary if any true experience of reconciliation with God, others, the creation, and ourselves is to take place. And it's the essays are like full of these crazy ideas.
That's plenty for Russell to respond to there. I wish we had longer to debate some of these issues. You know, the phrase whiteness alone obviously has all kinds of places we could go with it. But okay, so I'm anticipating your response here, Russell. Well, I don't agree with everything every scholar says about the way we need to treat these texts or whatever, but is there some truth in, you know, those kinds of quotes about, look, if we just had received our texts through a very different filter, a very different cultural filter, we might come out with some kind of different doctrines about Christianity?
Yeah, I think one of the things, and I will remind all of us the fact that in my article I do significantly criticize critical race theory and critical theory in general, and for its epistemological contradictions that are there within. So I know I've been kind of in this mode of kind of seeing value, but I do want to recognize that I see contradiction, and that's a problem. But when it comes,
I mean, you do call it The Promise and Perils of CRT.
Yes, right.
That's the subtitle of your article. Yes.
Yeah. Ultimately, you know, any attempts? Well, I'll let Herman Bavinck do kind of the heavy lifting. He wrote, wisdom is grounded on science, but is not limited to it. And then Nathaniel Grace Sutanto, he recently wrote a really insightful article about Bavinck, where he talks about this issue of worldview and some of these, the ways that we come to think about it now. He says, Bavinck was eager to present Christianity not just as an opposing philosophy, but rather as a fuller philosophy that fulfills and accommodates other worldviews. He wants to show that Christianity offers a pervasive metaphysics that is anticipated by and fulfills the perspectives of philosophers and scientists. And what I think Sutanto was saying and what he's reading from Bavinck is that sometimes we have this approach to worldview that looks to delegitimize and to essentially cancel anybody who may come from a different worldview because wait a minute, they might smuggle in perspectives that are, you know, that are different than are not true. But honestly, if we look at Christianity as what he's saying Bavinck did, is the fulfillment that one in the Hebrew tradition of wisdom, that wisdom was higher than knowledge, and that there was a sense of skill for living. Some of that skill embodies this aspect of lived experience, that there's some aspect of mystery that has often been lost in the not just Western tradition, but the post-Enlightenment rationalistic emphasis tradition that sees that as the only way of knowing, and that has lost some of those more mystical ways and approaches, lost some of the wonder, lost some of the mystery. And so I haven't read that article that he quoted fully from, so I'm not going to try to, you know, respond fully to it, but I will say I could see a scenario where there is a different mindset and mission to go in and say, I have to bring God to the heathen that was had within it a lot of a lot of bad theology, a lot of race and racism, because it was heathens and savages that had no knowledge of God, as opposed to saying, I'm going to show up where God has already in some place revealed himself, which we know just from the aspect of common grace and general revelation is a principle, but that may not be fully revealed. In the book, Eternity in Their Hearts, there's story after story after story that Bill Richardson reveals about how when people came to show up and they started explaining about this person who died for their sin and resurrected, they're like, oh, they already had it built into their tradition and they were looking for that. There's a different mindset of joining God in mission versus I am the person that's the victor that's coming in to save and not do what one of the colonels in the American army did in the 1870s when they were trying to figure out the Indian problem. And instead of just wiping them all out, which was the previous strategy, they decided to create boarding schools to kill the Indian and save the man. This is a intersection of culture, of spirit, of religious ideology, and all mixed in together in someone's soteriology that to them to be Christian meant to cut their hair, to disconnect them from their language, to strip them of their clothes and their culture in order to save the man. So when I think about that, I go, yeah, that needs to be critiqued because that is a horrible witness to the world. And it's totally, you know, an unjust system that has happened. And those vestiges of that still exist. And so when we think about missions today, it's just been in within the last century that, you know, Hudson Taylor and others, the influence of them that says, oh, wait a minute, I can just embody the culture that I'm in and not try to completely destroy it.
It's been a fascinating discussion, both. Thank you very much. Final thoughts, if you would, both folks. Where do we, I guess, move on from here? What would you like to see people go away with, Neil, from this when it comes to how they go and actually engage in practical ways with people of other color and everything else? What's the kind of practical takeaway for the Christian who's thinking, I've heard a lot, what do I go and do now?
One thing I would just say is that the Bible and the Christian worldview have all we need for life and godliness. You know, so that's true. We can learn things from, you know, other disciplines, from secular disciplines. That's true, but we have to always test it against the Bible. So obviously, you know, you don't have to reject modern medicine, you don't have to reject science as a Christian, but you have to test what people are telling you against Scripture primarily. And my worry here is that when you look at the actual core tenets of critical race theory as they're expounded by these theorists, they conflict in so many places overtly with what the Bible teaches. Now, if you want to take a truth here and a truth there and say, well, I can learn from that truth and that truth, that's fine. But please make clear to people exactly where the conflict lies. There's a deep, deep, deep foundational conflict in a way of viewing reality that's happening all over the place. And when you begin to see seminary professors not spitting out the bones, but choking on the bones, when you see them saying outrageous things, you ought to be worried and you ought to wonder, how should I hand these books to a random layperson in my congregation if even seminary professors are getting confused and buying into dangerous doctrines? That's what I would worry about. And I see it happening more and more. So I agree with Pastor Russell. We should be kind, charitable. We should listen carefully. We should not jump to conclusions. We should ask questions. But I think we also have to stand firm by saying this really is a movement, an ideology, even a worldview maybe, that is tremendously influential in our culture and is eroding the Christian faith in many ways. And we have to stand against it. Doesn't mean being a big jerk, but it means identifying the problems and saying, stay away from these.
Final thoughts from you as well, Razul. Yeah.
First of all, let me say I commend Neil for his commitment to the gospel. As someone who's an evangelist at heart, an apologist at heart, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to move to New York City, because I saw the danger of postmodernism and the influence that it was having on worldview. And I wanted to kind of get into the belly of the beast to understand how to contend for the faith in a time where people are looking at it and calling it and considering it post-Christian. So I appreciate that effort. I appreciate the zeal in which you want to guard against that. And I do recognize that the slippage that is occurring in the ways in which the foundation, so to speak, of people's confidence in the Bible, confidence in an objective truth of Jesus' salvation is waning in different ways. I mean, you can just look at Pew Research or Barna and see, the trends that exist. And I'm deeply concerned about that. And I've seen that in our own congregation. So I'm not here to deny that. At the same time, Dr. Carl Ellis, who's an incredible mentor, he wrote a book, Free at Last, where he talks about side A and side B of the gospel. Side A being the epistemological concerns, side B being the ethical concerns, that ultimately people in positions of power oftentimes are more focused on the epistemological than the ethical. Right now, we're in an incredible season of suffering in our world when you look at a global pandemic, and one that doesn't play fair, that it disproportionately impacts people who are suffering, that the Bible talks about the poor, the oppressed, the foreigner, which you can kind of invest in that, this idea of ethnic difference, that these are problems. We have a legacy of rape. As an apologist in the Black community, the number one issue that I have is with people who say Christianity is a white man's religion, because look at what it's done. Mm. And so I have to contend against that. That's what I'm up against. So when I talk about the liberation themes in the Bible, it's not because I'm being influenced by something that started being written in the 1970s. It's because I'm drawing from the Frederick Douglasses, who said that, I love the pure, peaceable religion of Christ, which is why I despise the hypocritical, slaveholding, women whipping religion of this land. Between the two, there can be no greatest separation. When I look at the ESV Study Bible and I look in Luke chapter 4, verse 18, and its note for when Jesus says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he's anointed me to proclaim, freedom to the captive, recovery of sight to the blind, it notes Jesus's ministry included forgiveness, forgiving sins, and ethical teachings that promote social justice. That is just there. And so I am for promoting this aspect of ethical concern and justice in a time in which is desperately needed. And even when our witness as apologists demand that we give an answer, and more than just in words, but in actions about what's happening. And so to me, because I want to be faithful as an evangelist, that also means proclaiming good news, not just in my words, but in my actions. That's what we try to do with being anti-racist.
Thank you so much both for being such great guests, and just for this really helpful opening up of this discussion, and for being gracious as well in the way that you've engaged with each other. I'll make sure there are links to you both from today's show as well, if you want to find out more about Russell and Neil. But for now, thanks very much for being with me on today's program.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks, Russell. Yep.
Yeah.
Look forward to hearing what you made of today's programme. You're welcome to email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Always read all the emails I get. Can't respond to them all. Can't read them all out on the show either, but I do enjoy reading them all regularly when they come in. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Social media is at unbelievablejb for Twitter to tell me what you think. facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook page. And you can get in touch via Instagram too these days, justin.brierley. And as you'll hear in my conversation with Ruth Jackson in just a moment's time, we've even got plans to take on TikTok as well, believe it or not. So Ruth will be here in just a moment's time to talk about some of the plans we've got in store. Just before we get to that, thanks to others who've been getting in touch about last week's Eric Metaxas and David French debate on Donald Trump, and indeed the John Steingard and Amy Orr Ewing discussion on suffering as well. We'll try and squeeze in some of your thoughts on those. Just a quick shout out though to Leah in Michigan, USA, says, I've been listening for about a year now to Unbelievable. Found it through the NT Wright podcast. Love how completely neutral you remain, Justin, as a proper debate narrator should be. But I'm waiting to hear a good debate between a Catholic and Protestant about their doctrinal views on items such as faith versus works, confession, the Eucharist, veneration of Mary and the saints. Please consider. Well, Leah, always a good topic to return to. We have in the vast back catalogue now of, you know, some 11 or 12 years worth of Unbelievable shows, got quite a few of those kinds of debates if you want to go back and explore the back catalogue. So I'd recommend you do that. David gets in touch on the issue of fundamentalism, says, just thought I'd drop you a note in between podcasts. I'm an Unbelievable addict. Can I thank you for all you do for the church? The Unbelievable podcasts are unbelievably good. To hear wide-ranging speakers on topics that I never, ever thought I'd get to hear is awesome. I'm blessed beyond measure. Thankful for all of Premier Radio's work. And I've got a topic close to my heart, Christian fundamentalism. I grew up in the Free Presbyterian Church of Ulster, and boy, I can't say how fundamentalism has brought the glorious gospel to a narrow, twisted, weak thing. I credit the sermon 10 Shekels and a Shirt by Paris Reedhead as the first thing to make me think and realise the view of Christianity I grew up with was a stripped-down gospel. Please don't hesitate to email me if it's of interest. I can flesh out examples on what I mean. Thank you, David, for that offer. And I suppose in some ways we do often look at the intersection between more liberal and more conservative, you know, versions of Christianity. Fundamentalism, I suppose, to some extent exists in its own category, and perhaps we could have a debate on that at some point. But appreciate all of the emails we get, and we'll hear some more of them in a moment. It's my great pleasure to welcome onto the show now Ruth Jackson, who is the newest member of the Unbelievable team, and in a way, the only other member.
I was just about to say.
Because I've never had a co-worker, colleague, to name that, you know, on Unbelievable. So this is all very exciting and has only been the case for about the last month or so. But Ruth, welcome along to Unbelievable.
Thanks very much. Very exciting.
Now, regular listeners might have met you already when you joined us recently for that discussion on coronavirus 6 months on. And we had a little bit of your story as regards your recent experience with coronavirus yourself. But what we didn't really get to talk about then, and what I'd love to chat about now, is the fact that you've recently joined the good ship Unbelievable. And you're bringing all kinds of specialisms and skills to the party. We're really excited about some of the things that we're going to be working on over the next couple of years together. We're still kind of working on exactly what your title is, but yeah, we're going with something like project manager and youth specialist or something like that.
Sounds very grand.
It does. But I can just say personally, I have so enjoyed, especially, you know, under these sort of lockdown type circumstances, working remotely that we're still doing, just having you to bounce off and talk things through and just get excited about what the future could hold for Unbelievable, which for me is a great blessing. So welcome, Ruth.
Thank you.
So I just want Unbelievable listeners, though, to find out a bit more about you, because they're going to be seeing and hearing from you more in coming months. So take us back. What was life? Where did things begin for you? Did you grow up in a sort of Christian home? Mm-hmm. What were the questions that were going on as you started to develop in that way?
So I grew up in inner city Manchester. My dad was a vicar, so I'm a classic PK, pastor's kid. But he was very much given, so he's got a really fruity background, was, you know, sort of became a Christian by beating up a bouncer. And, you know, he came from a very, very broken background, came to faith as a teenager through all sorts of circumstances. Maybe I'll tell his story at some point.
Well, I was going to say, at some point, I have to hear how beating up a bouncer led to him becoming a Christian, but we'll leave that for another day.
Okay. So he, and, you know, didn't have any GCSEs or A-levels, got kicked out of school at 14 for throwing a brick at a teacher. So he sort of came from quite a, like a working class inner city background. So when he became a vicar after about 8 selection conferences that he failed and failed and failed, he was very much tasked with the role of church planting in sort of fairly deprived areas. So that was the context that I grew up in. We always had, you know, various people who were broken in different ways, staying at our house or in and out of our house. So I just kind of thought it was normal to have those sorts of people in our house, which was amazing. And they, you know, my parents totally lived everything that they said. But I guess I just didn't really know any different. And then I went to university to study theology, went to Oxford. And I remember when I was doing that, loads of people, not necessarily in my church, but I suppose Christians I knew, were like, oh, are you sure you want to study theology? You know, lots of people lose their faith by studying theology. And I kind of thought, well, yeah, maybe, but if I'm going to lose my faith studying it, then it's clearly not a faith worth holding anyway. So sort of went to university, and actually a lot of people's warnings were sort of, you know, not without warrant, because within the first few weeks, I'd kind of met a ton of super, super smart atheist professors and atheist fellow students who just asked so many good questions and really challenged my beliefs on stuff, particularly when it came to kind of biblical criticism and, you know, looking at like what was actually true and what was verifiable. And so I did sort of find myself having this kind of intellectual crisis of faith. But thanks to amazing people like Michael Green, and lots of other like smart Christian theologians, a lot of the guys who are now at the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, sort of helped me build it. I wouldn't say I ever lost my faith, but I was just trying to reconcile all of it. So I think a combination of chatting to these super smart people who were also Christians and reading the Bible a lot for myself, rather than, I guess, just kind of taking in what I'd heard growing up. So I read the Bible probably like 3 or 4 times in my first year of university, like just cover to cover. So this is, in fact, I've got it here. This is my student Bible. It is slightly falling apart.
That, well, you know what they say about a Bible that's falling apart? Usually the person reading it isn't. But anyway, it's great to hear that story. And obviously you've really engaged with the intellectual side of Christianity from early on in that way. Though I think you come from a family that's also quite creative, artsy. Yeah. You've got sisters. In fact, you're one of the twins, actually. And there's a lot of kind of drama and stuff as well in your family, isn't there?
Yeah.
Is that kind of something that you found like you wanted to bring together in some way, the kind of the Christian stuff and the
creative side? Guess I always thought I was going to be like an actor or a creative in some sense. My mum was a dance teacher, so both my sisters were in musical theatre, both my in-laws were in musical theatre, like, you know, their husbands were in musical theatre, so, you know, it's very sort of creative family. My husband's a musician, so I guess like when I left, I don't think theology necessarily sets you up with like a direct career path unless you want to go into the ministry, which as a pastor's kid I was like, not a chance. So I guess I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and then I started working for the BBC, which in some ways was like the perfect combination, because I got to kind of use all my creativity, and I got to use my brain. So I was like writing scripts and coming up with ideas, and I really wanted to work for BBC Religion because I wanted to like use my theology degree and kind of the creative thing. But I basically got so I was doing a job at the BBC for kind of the commercial arm of the BBC, and then I ended up at Blue Peter, which was absolutely amazing. And, you know, making children's television.
For our lovely American listeners who may not know what this institution is, that anyone living in the UK should know what it is, Blue Peter, but it's a long running children's TV program, which has been going since, I don't know, the 1950s or something.
Yeah.
And has, you know, been a staple part of children's TV in the UK for a long, long time. But you actually got to work as a sort of producer of sorts on that for a few years.
Yeah, and it was an amazing experience. But I suppose all the time while I was doing that and making lots of brilliant content for children, there was still this niggle at the back of my mind. I really want to work for BBC Religion. I want to make like specifically religious content. And then my final stint at the BBC was on Songs of Praise, which again, for our American audience, is, oh gosh, how do you describe Songs of Praise? I suppose it's a little bit magazine show, a little bit worship program.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah, it's very, I mean, the thing is that UK media and American media is so different in nature that it's very hard to explain that this is a religious show, but on a essentially secular, you know, station.
Public television.
The BBC. But anyway, yes. But go on. So you had this sort of background then in media, and you started thinking, oh, maybe I can do something in religious media. But what happened in the end?
Yeah, so I ended up at Songs of Praise and was working in Manchester in the offices there. And then it all kind of came to an end. So basically, television is quite like an unstable world unless you are contracted to a particular company. And basically, it was when all of the London offices were moving up to Manchester and everything was slightly in sort of, there was like lots of confusion around people's jobs and things like that. And around that time, when I wasn't really sure whether I would be able to stay at the BBC, I spotted on Alistair McGrath's Facebook page that he was looking for someone to kind of help them, I guess, kind of kickstart the media for the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics. And Alistair McGrath was one of my tutors at Oxford, and I've always had a massive theological crush on him. I want his brain effectively. I love him so much. So I just thought, if there's any opportunity to work with Alistair McGrath and also the other people at the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, then I'm in. So I kind of went down for an interview to Oxford and was interviewed by a guy called Tom Price. Turns out we went to the same school, so we just had like so much in common.
And Tom's been a guest on the show before as well.
He has, yeah. And so that was it, really. So then I job shared with another brilliant lady for a while. So I was doing like 2 days a week, I think, at the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, living in London, working in Oxford.
Wow.
Like, bit of a whirlwind of a kind of experience. But and then I ended up being full time there. So did that for 4 years, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, so you've had the amazing experience, and at the same time, sort of been quite involved in youth work on a local level in churches and so on, and alongside your husband Will, and eventually we nabbed you at Premier Towers, and you spent a number of years editing Premier Youth and Children's Work magazine. Tell us a little bit about the experience of doing that and what that kind of brought along.
Yeah, so that was amazing. So I guess while I was at the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, and potentially even while I was at Blue Peter, I would write the odd article here and there for the magazine as a volunteer youth worker. I've never ever been a sort of professional youth worker. I have zero training. It's just, it's just what I've done kind of on the side. It's just been my passion. And so then when I came on board, I felt completely unqualified, but actually it was just an incredible privilege. We sort of described the editor role as, well, the magazine's role as a whole is to kind of like a hug for kind of encouraging youth workers and children's workers who are having a bit of a difficult time. And I suppose to let them know that they're not the only people struggling with these things, but also like a gentle push up the bottom, little nudge to be like, come on, you can do better, you can do more, that kind of thing. So we sort of saw ourselves as like a dual encouragement but also challenge. So just such an incredible privilege to travel across the country and meet youth workers and children's workers in so many different contexts and get to tell them they were doing a great job, get to pray with them, get to see what they were doing, get to kind of connect them with other people. Just just an amazing job.
I mean, even before you took that role on, I was inviting you to unbelievable conferences to talk, and you've carried that on once you were in your role with YCW and so on. So in a way, we've worked closely together in those years, sat next to each other in the office for a number of years. We can't sit next to each other now at the moment under remote working conditions, but we hope to again at some point. But
which, let's be honest, Justin, is probably a good thing, because both of our desks are such a mess. It would, it would just be like mayhem.
Annoy everyone on either side of us with our messiness. Anyway, events have transpired that you were able to come over to Unbelievable this year, which, as I say, I'm really enjoying the way we're able to work together now. In many ways, as well as obviously helping with all the things that we put out on a regular basis, the show, the videos, the social media, we're looking at developing new resources, new ways to go. Tell us. We've been hatching a few plans, haven't we?
We have.
For what? Because we think youth apologetics is very under-resourced. There's some really good people doing great stuff out there, but still, there's so much more that could be done. So we're just sort of trying to see what we might be able to think up and dream up, aren't we, at the moment?
Yeah, for sure. So it's interesting. Some people describe me as an apologist. I'm very much not an apologist. I have no training in this area at all. Sure, I've got a theology degree, but like, who hasn't? And so
who hasn't?
I very I mean, Justin hasn't, but he definitely knows way more than me. So I very much see myself as like bringing complicated things into the vernacular, because I kind of think there's so much stuff out there that's I listen to some episodes of things, not unbelievable, but you know, some things, and I just think, I've got an Oxford theology degree and I have not got a clue what you're talking about. I can't even understand your
reference. Some episodes of Unbelievable,
I mean, maybe like one or two,
come on now.
But I very much see myself as kind of simplifying. Sounds like I'm dumbing it down. I don't think we need to dumb it down, but I think, I guess, like one thing that I'd love to do that we've talked about a little bit is get these super smart guests and sort of say to them, right, if you had to whittle down what you think in 1 minute to a 10-year-old, how would you say it? Because I just think actually it's not just 10-year-olds that would be interested in that. I would be interested in that. And in some ways it would be a really interesting insight into what they're going to say in the program. And then if it's something you want to hear more about, you can then listen to the whole program. So that's one of the ideas we had. I suppose a lot of the other things are about kind of resourcing parents or creating just kind of short bite-sized things for young people, youth workers, things like that. One thing that I'm very excited about is Justin Brawley is now on TikTok, people. What's your handle, Justin?
Well, I'm actually not even going to say it because we haven't really got any material on this TikTok. But my
watch
son,
this space.
As you know, my son Noah is 15 years old and he has already like conquered TikTok basically as this sort of young entrepreneurial teenager. So I'm playing just catch up with my son at this point, and I'm hoping that together, you and I, Ruth, can bring some interesting material that kind of fits the TikTok 1 minute kind of just fun, silly kind of vibe. Because if you want to reach young people, you kind of have to go where young people are. And evidently, I sound like such an old crusty fogey when I say this kind of thing. Oh, that's where the young people are. We must go and find them there. But yeah, that's basically the idea. You might as well go and actually try and make an impact on the platforms that young people are actually using. So that's the plan. And we would value any help from anyone who's listening who thinks they could help us out with that as well.
For sure.
Because we're all learning. So there are plans afoot, and lots of other plans. You know, we've got all sorts of things coming up on the agenda, another big conversation season in the new year that we're working on as well, and much more besides. So it's all very exciting. And perhaps even more excitingly, I will get to occasionally have a week off now and then from actually presenting the show, because you are a very skilled presenter yourself, Ruth. And so we in just a couple of weeks' time, while I'm having a little break with the family, you're going to do a special show. Do you want to tell us a bit about what listeners can expect?
Yeah, for sure. So I didn't really fancy my first show being one of those ones that I don't even understand. So I thought, let's go where I know, like, even just a little bit. So I thought youth would be a kind of good place to do. So I've got two people coming on, and we're basically going to discuss, we haven't quite formulated the question, but discuss the idea of whether you should bring up children in a particular faith or belief system. So one person who is a humanist who doesn't think that you should bring them up in a particular system, but you should let them kind of come to their own decisions and sort of survey things and then make their own choices. And one who is a Christian, was brought up in a Christian household and is bringing their children up in a Christian household. So obviously does think that that's what they want to do. So I think there'll be lots of points of agreement, but I also think fundamentally they will disagree on that main point. So it'll be really interesting, I think.
Absolutely. I'm really looking forward to listening back to that one. So look out for that in a couple of weeks' time. There'll be a debate on whether we should bring kids up religious or not. Richard Dawkins, I think, famously said that he thought that bringing kids up in a religious household was tantamount to child abuse. So I don't know if either of our guests will go that far. But anyway, it should be an interesting debate. It's been just great just to have the chance to introduce you, Ruth, to Unbelievable, and we're really looking forward to all that you will offer and bring in the course of the show. So thank you very much for being with me on the show.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Brilliant stuff. I'll make sure there's a link from today's show to where you can find out more about Ruth and some of the resources she's already worked hard on over the last few years. But for now, thanks, Ruth, and we'll see you soon.
Yeah, see you soon.
Okay, going a bit long to bring you some extra feedback today, but we have had a lot in response to particularly Trump. That has been a very, very popular show. Should Christians vote for Donald Trump. We were airing the debate that took place between David French and Eric Metaxas recently at John Brown University's Center for Faith and Flourishing. Thanks again to those who allowed us to rebroadcast that debate. It was heated at times, forthright, to say the least. There were some interesting moments, particularly Eric Metaxas's very first out-of-the-gate comment, which I understand people have told me is some kind of Saturday Night Live reference, but I think it fell a bit flat, in all honesty, as I think he realised when it came out. But anyway, thanks for all of the responses. Let's just get some of what came in on Twitter here. A lot of people are very thankful for airing the debate, but David Robertson perhaps sums up the feelings of a number of people, saying one of the most disappointing and unhelpful debates on Unbelievable. Not your fault, Justin, but I found this to be shallow, partisan, and rarely getting to a Christian perspective on things, more like Twitter than the normal Unbelievable. And then, of course, people were very much split between who came out better, who made the best arguments. Jordan Durstein said the debate was bonkers. Does Eric Metaxas really believe Black Lives Matter and the radical left are compromised or in control of Joe and the Dems? This is such fear-mongering. He sounded like he was paid to say these things. Rich Benavides said, we have hired a man to hate for us. We've hired a man to be cruel for us. Wow, perfect summation from David French. Josh McBride, oof, what a listen. I admittedly have an opinion on this and a far stronger one at that. French presented some strong points and offers, in my opinion, a healthy version of conservatism. Metaxas' points didn't impress me and his delivery was lacking. And Jeff said, thanks for broadcasting this. I side thoroughly with French and thought he exposed the folly of Trump in the Q&A especially, but it was also helpful to hear why someone might vote for Trump. On the other side, people like Andy Smith said, I thought there could be no bigger useful idiot in America politics than David Frum, but then I came across David French. French obliviously asserts a number of items here as if they were known fact when there are other plausible explanations. Someone else tweets, I couldn't vote for Donald Trump in 2016 because I didn't trust his temperament and words, but 4 years later, he has an actual record to look at. We're doing well. Actions speak louder than others' words. I'm truly astounded at the willful blindness. Dan Riggs, David's naivety about the ramifications of a Biden presidency is astounding. He will regret misleading people down the line. Save this recording. The recording is saved. It's in the Unbelievable back catalogue. Thank you very much for the many, many other tweets and responses that came in as well on Facebook and Instagram to that debate too. But here's some of your thoughts on the email as well. Tim in Etna, Ohio says, as an evangelical who's struggling to choose between the two primary candidates in this year's presidential election, I was looking forward to the debate in order to hear a knowledgeable, respectful discussion on the issues. What a disappointment. What I heard was just more of the same whiny bickering of which we in the US have grown extremely weary. David French sounded like he was reading from multiple left-biased editorial pages. Eric came across as a warm-up actor at a Trump campaign rally. Maybe I've been spoiled by the exceptional guests on Unbelievable and the resulting enlightened dialogue. This debate was just another frustrating exercise in petty partisan politics. It's a tongue twister. But thank you, Tim, in Etna, Ohio, for getting in touch. Preston in Oklahoma says, want to say how awesome the show is. Thank you, Preston. Sometimes the conversation and words you use are above me, but thankful for the ministry you've engaged in. As a 23-year-old follower of Jesus, I voted for President Trump in the 2016 election and am planning to in the upcoming election. There are different political sects in America that I guess need to be understood first. People on the left, because they feel morally obligated to be, see conservatives as the enemies, moderates who see Trump as unlikable and a buffoon, people on the right who have voting priorities that Trump represents, and then the blind followers of Trump's who are unable to see any of the man's flaws. After listening to the debate, I found it hard to identify with Eric, finding myself wanting him to appeal to my faith in Jesus more than he tried to, while Mr. French did so constantly, making biblically sound points. And yet the one area that almost every follower of Jesus in America wanted to hear the most, he gave a weak, very brief answer for on the defense of the unborn. I just don't understand and can sometimes feel lost in the midst of all this. If we all agree life begins at conception, how could we not prioritize putting another justice on the Supreme Court who is going to fight for the unborn children who have been killed off in the millions? Confused by Mr. French. Hopefully this gets to him somehow so I can hear more succinctly what he thinks. Thank you, Preston. And Luke Zinza says, long-time listener, occasional feedbacker, love the show and your commitment to healthy debate. But this show bothered me, though I realize it wasn't hosted by you. There are approximately 140 million citizens in the US eligible to hold the office of the US president. The United States is second in the world for number of universities, one of the highest percentages of population that's completed tertiary education. The statistics could lead one to assume there's a large talent pool in the US for people to hold some sort of political office. So I'm confused on why there's a debate on who Christians should vote for in the upcoming election. The question that really should be asked is, since the US has perpetually put forward candidates that do not meet Christian moral and ethical benchmarks, and there is a seemingly large amount of qualified potential candidates, shouldn't the Christian community start right now looking for potential presidential candidates that meet that benchmark? Thank you, Luke. Sorry, I can't read all of your email. And I'll just read one more from Samuel, this time not from the US, in Varberg, Sweden, says, thanks for a great program. Normally, the show leaves a good aftertaste, given the respectful and truth-seeking approach your guests engender. But I found Unbelievable a year ago and have listened through most of the back catalogue. This episode, though, I was struck by the miserable state of the political discourse in the US, saddened by the episode since it showed how deep the split is, even among Christians. In the debate between French and Metaxas, there was no seeking of common ground, lots of talking points and high-pitched emotional rhetoric that makes nobody wiser. On a more serious note, though, through the debate was the notion of American exceptionalism, the idea that God has a special plan for the US. Classic Christian values such as forgiveness, turning the other cheek, reconciliation were mostly absent from the debate. Render unto Caesar what belongs to God is not what Jesus said, but is precisely what happens when religious ideals are translated into and enforced as earthly laws. N.T. Wright for president, you end up saying, Samuel, in Varberg, Sweden. Thank you very much. All right, just one more. Luke from New Zealand. Eric Metaxas and David French made me sad. It didn't seem to me like a measured and respectful debate. If two people who, from what I could tell, were united on the majority of actual policy issues for the US can be so divided on how to vote, there's something very wrong. If the representatives aren't representative, then the system is broken. As someone not from the US, I don't know how I'd vote, but I can understand and sympathize with Americans who pick either side. I hope and pray that America as a country can work out a way to talk together about the issues, not just about allegiances. Maybe then they might find their positions much closer than previously appeared. Well, time's running out, and we had lots more responses on Trump via email, Twitter, Facebook, etc. And since time's running out, I'll just bring one email. This was lovely from Chris in response to Amyor Ewing and John Steingard's discussion on suffering. Chris said, just wanted to let you know this show was not the only show to knock it out of the park, but this show with the guests that you chose came off incredible. In my opinion, it helped that the topic was also appropriate for the times we're all going through right now globally. I've been listening since March 2015. Your show's one of the best on the planet. I've told so many people about it. They just have not figured it out yet, lol, says Chris. Thank you, Chris. Good to know we've got evangelists for Unbelievable all over the place. Yes, if you know someone who would appreciate today's show, then why not send it on to them? And do check out, by the way, if you're interested in some more thoughts on that Amy or Ewing and John Steingard discussion on suffering that took place a couple of weeks ago. Lovely blog on it by Ruth Jackson, again, on the Pathos blog. So she's got some great thoughts on the back of that particular discussion. So go and check that out. Pathos.com/blogs/unbelievable, something like that. But you'll get all of it if you subscribe to the newsletter as well. Great way to do that from the US is our new website, unbelievable.show. Everywhere else, you can still subscribe via premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Click on newsletter. For now, thanks for being with me. Let me tell you what's coming up next week. Your opportunity to ask Alistair McGrath anything. That's what we'll be airing on next week's show. But you can be part of that show by joining us on Wednesday, the 21st of October, from 8 p.m. UK time on our Facebook page, or over at our YouTube channel as well. That's 3 p.m. on that Wednesday if you're in the States on Eastern Time. Alistair's new memoir just got published, Through a Glass Darkly, Journeys Through Science, Faith and Doubt. But he'll be taking a whole range of questions, so do join us for that if you can this Wednesday on our Facebook page and YouTube channel. Until then, have a great week. See you next time.
You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.